And now, Icon Art Radio. Today's episode, the first part of Bill and Donna's interview with sound artist Alan Cobb.
Hi, this is Bill Teeple with Donna Colby and Alan Cobb, and this is Icon Art Radio. Last week, we interviewed the visual artist Robert Horline, and an interesting thing came up at the time, and that is they got talking about Alan's interest in sound art.
And actually, the first time I met Alan Cobb in 1973, I believe it was, was completely based on his curiosity about sound. We were both working at MIU Press in Santa Monica, California, and we had offices next to each other. And he had just arrived, and I didn't know him at all. And I worked in the film and tape library, where we had a record player, and I was used to playing music while I worked. And I was playing a Fats Waller record, and I prided myself on my knowledge of Fats Waller. And suddenly this head popped in the door, naming the tune Fats Waller and rattling off a marvelous batch of stories about Fats Waller, none of which I had ever heard before. So that was my introduction to the unique character of Alan Cobb. And I've actually kind of had a curiosity ever since then about how you started in your curiosity about sound and your knowledge about all of its...
Well, it's actually kind of an interesting story. I didn't even realize myself until a few years ago that I've been into sound in a kind of unusual sense pretty much all my life. When I was a kid, I was interested in technology and gadgets and things, some of them involved sound, and I thought that was interesting, but I didn't realize until recently that actually most of the things I did had something to do with sound. One of my earliest memories is sitting under the grand piano in our house in New York City and looking up at the beautiful, wood sounding board when my mother was playing the piano, or my sister. And I spent endless hours messing around on that piano long before I was old enough to take piano lessons, or at least long before my parents thought I was old enough to take piano lessons. And I took piano lessons for several years, and I could sight read and stuff like that. And I really can't anymore. My chops are pretty lame as a keyboard artist performing live. But I think that's because my interest was only partly in the music. Music is wonderful, and I totally love it. Experimental music, classical, jazz, electronic, and just about all culture, world music that I've heard. Some of it takes a little time to figure out what they're doing, which reveals something interesting about what music is. But maybe that's for another talk. My father was a surgeon, and he was also kind of a Renaissance man, and he was always building things and fixing things and writing poetry. And one area of life that he had never gotten into and always regretted was music. So he encouraged his three kids to spend as much time as possible developing musical skills if they liked it. So I was in a semi-musical family, and my dad's dream, he had rescued an old telescope from a neighbor's house one day when they were cleaning things up. And he wanted to build an observatory in the upper field in a place we had up the Hudson. And he had managed to rescue two upright pianos that were being thrown away by other neighbors, old, totally destroyed upright pianos. And he saved the harps from them. These are the old, tall uprights that have a really big harp in them. And his idea was to make a pair of gates to the upper field out of piano harps, and they would, in effect, be Aeolian harps. And of course, as many of you know, an Aeolian harp is simply harp played by the wind. Well, the gates never got built, but I can remember at the age of 6 or 7 standing in one of the stalls in the barn with a piano harp on either side of me, a naked piano harp, leaning up against either side of the stall. And the stalls were fairly narrow, and I could stand there with a screwdriver in one hand and a hammer handle in the other hand and play both of those harps at the same time in stereo. And I guess I should mention this was before stereo, before it had been invented. So that puts me in a particular group of people we fondly know of as the baby boomers. Well, my father had a wire recorder that got upgraded to a disc recording machine for dictation, and I inherited the wire recorder at about that age, 7 or 8.
What is a wire recorder? Can you?
It's like a tape recorder, but it records on a very, very fine strand of silver wire, that silver colored wire that is about as fine as a human hair. And it goes by at about 3 or 4 feet per second. So you have these spools with miles and miles and miles of this super fine tempered wire that accepts a recording, and it goes through a big clunky groove in a head that's going up and down to feed it onto a big take-up spool the size of a 78 RPM record. The thing that was interesting about the wire recorder is I started recording things on this sort of discarded technology, which wasn't that obsolete in those days, but it was a heck of a lot less convenient than recording on the new dictaphone, which made little green records. When you break the wire, which is fairly easy to do because it's so fine, the way you splice it is you simply tie a square knot in it. And I thought that was wonderful, and it's a delightfully low-tech way of dealing with it. In fact, it's easier to splice than magnetic tape in that sense, because you don't have to align anything. You just, you know, if you can tie a knot in a hair, then you're
so what
you're
happens
all set.
If you're playing it back and you hit one of those knots?
The knot just goes through the head, and the head doesn't notice, and there's no click or pop or anything, and it just sounds great. So in my early fiddling with the wire recorder, I would occasionally, you know, lose control of some wire and it would bunch up on the floor. And when you pull the wire tight, if there's a loop in it and it goes tight into a kink, the wire just breaks. You can't bend it that sharply. So I would end up with several broken pieces of wire on the floor. And I just thought, well, I don't want to lose this because there are only so many spools of this stuff here. So I tied them back together again. You know, I just knotted them all back together. And of course, some of the segments that I tied back in were backwards and some were forwards. And then we're all out of sequence too. So I heard myself talking, and then I heard myself talking backwards, and then I heard myself starting a few words and then turning into other words and then other words that were backwards. And it just fascinated me. I thought it was a really wonderful thing. But I was 7 or 8 and I didn't know that what I was doing was actually this very same thing that the now, world-famous founders of electronic music were doing in their laboratories in Paris at that time, right? And this was probably, 1952 or something like that, when tape recorders were just appearing on the scene in large numbers, and people were experimenting with them in laboratories and discovering, you know, that you could reverse the tape and play it at different speeds and things. So at the age of 7, I was a pioneer in electronic music, but I thought I was just having fun, so I didn't mention it to anybody.
Remember when we talked about my history, that I felt like I had launched on my career as an artist at 8.
Yeah.
And you launched at 7 or 8.
Yeah, 7 or 8. I really don't know what year it was.
All right.
But that has kind of persisted, and I realized after I moved to Fairfield about 5 years ago that I kept coming back to music and sound, and I discovered that really what I wanted to do was explore sound itself, more than music. And that's kind of what led me into my present work.
Maybe there's some terms you should define so that you don't go off and leave the audience behind.
Yeah, do it.
Because he's working in a very interesting area of art. I've always been fascinated with Alan's work, and it's way opened up a whole new area of art for me. I call what he does sound sculpture, because he's sculpting space sonically. And let's say a few things.
Yeah, well, there's a, you know, we normally think of sound as a thing, a series of things. You hear a voice and you think of the voice as a sound, and you think of the words maybe as individual sounds. But in fact, there are some dimensions of sound that we generally don't pay conscious attention to. And what intrigues me the most is what's called timbre and what I call spatiality. I don't even know that there is a name for it as such. When you listen to music, you're listening to harmony and pitch and meter. And melody and harmony are kind of the same thing, but in two different dimensions. When you listen to speech, you're listening to content. Your attention is entirely on content. When you're sitting in the living room and you hear a dog barking outside the house, that dog barking sound you think of as an item, and you identify it as dog barking, bell ringing, you know, that's the doorbell, that's a car door slamming. So these are what I call referential sounds. They're sounds that we identify as referring to some specific thing that we already know. And what we do when we listen to things, to music or anything, and we just experiencing through the senses, is we listen for the familiar. We listen for something that we can recognize. What makes music so satisfying, I think, at its core, is recognition of a theme that you heard a minute ago. You play a theme or a phrase, and then when you hear it a second time, you say, oh, I know that. And then, of course, with culture, you know, there are many, many layers of how you can play with that process of recognition that, for some reason, feels good. It's kind of a microscopic aha response. And when a melody resolves itself back to the tonic, you know, you say to yourself, yes, that's where it should have ended up, and it sounds right, and you recognize that it's finally returned to the notes that it started from. But these are very powerful forces, and I found that in order to explore timbre, I needed to get away from music, because when music is playing, you're listening to the melody. You're not listening to the timbre very much. What is timbre? It's the tonal quality of a sound. If you hear a flute playing three or four notes in a row, and then you hear a trumpet playing the same three or four notes, well, in a sense, how could they possibly be the same notes? They are happening later in a different place, coming out of a different instrument, but they're at the same pitch and they're played for the same duration and roughly the same loudness, and we think of them as the same. But we know one's a trumpet and one's a flute. That difference is the color of the sound, the texture of it, the tonality of it, and that all falls under the French word timbre, as we've anglicized it, and it basically just means the character of a sound. Then there's another dimension of sound, which is spatiality, and that's the way that we identify the environment through a sound. When you hear a flute playing, you don't hear a flute playing in a vacuum, usually. You hear a flute playing in a concert hall or in a recital hall. And you hear the roomness of that environment in the way the flute sounds. Now, of course, if you analyze it, you're listening to reverberations and things that are really not the flute, they're the walls of the room. But we're wired up to be incredibly sensitive to those signals, and they're so fundamental to our perception of hearing that we don't think about them at all, and we know instantly what's going on in the spatiality of a sound, and we don't dwell on it. Well, I wanted to dwell on it, and to do that, I had to eliminate music from the sounds that I was working with. I also had to eliminate metric qualities. I had to eliminate meter and tempo and rhythm. I had to eliminate referential sounds like car doors slamming and birds chirping and recognizable things, because they all pull the attention onto content. And I wanted to explore what sound is by itself, what the sound itself is. And Just to give you some examples of spatiality, I can post-process this recording that we're listening to now. This recording that we're creating now.
And make my voice sound very far away. So now I'm speaking from a great distance. I'll just move closer to the microphone, and you'll hear quite a difference in the way I'm speaking. Pardon the clunking.
Now I'm talking very close to the microphone, and you can tell that the spatiality information is completely different.
I could also be in a large room. I could be talking to you from a shower stall.
I could be speaking in a giant cathedral.
I could be speaking over the public address system in a huge public stadium.
Or this recording could be coming out of an old radio, assuming you're not already listening to it on an old radio. Or this could be a scratchy 78 RPM record with dust on it and warps and terrible frequency response. Or there could be a slap echo in the room, and so forth. And these are all different kinds of experiences that we have that tell us about the space that we're in. So I guess, you know, once you start paying attention to timbre, and especially spatiality, you really can no longer think of sound as individual events. Sound can mean a lot of different things. Usually we think of a sound as an individual, isolated thing. But from this new perspective, sound is a continuum. It's a field of vibratory space, which has no beginning or end or divisions. You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, an outreach program of Iowa Contemporary Art. This has been part one of Bill and Donna's interview with sound artist Alan Cobb. The second part of this program will air at this time next week here on KRUU LP 100.1 FM, Fairfield.